Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's 232-196 party line vote in the House to authorize and set the guidelines for the impeachment of President Trump, and speak with David Rothkopf, who was a senior official in the Clinton administration and the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, as well as the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. His forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump, and he joins us to discuss the narrow scope of the impeachment inquiry focusing on Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukraine's President Zelensky, and argues that there are so many other flagrant crimes in plain sight that Trump is guilty of, such as the obstructions of justice laid out in the Mueller report, violations of campaign laws and the Emoluments Clause, as well as laws regarding congressional oversight. We'll also look into the frighteningly abundant evidence that Trump, as our commander-in-chief, poses a clear and present danger to the U.S.'s national security, because if he is not a traitor, he is certainly working with Putin against U.S. efforts to protect and defend democracy and the rule of law in Ukraine. And even more alarming, Trump sells out our interests and our allies, the Kurds in Syria, after a private, secret conversation with Erdogan, which again harms America and our reputation while giving aid and comfort to Putin. Then, with the rising star among the new crop of freshman Democrats in the House, Katie Hill, giving her last speech today before Congress because of what she describes as a double standard, where the dirtiest gutter politics were used by operatives tied to the Republican Congressman Steve Knight, who she had defeated, who, along with right-wing media in a misogynistic culture, gleefully consumed naked pictures of her. Moira Donegan, a columnist for The Guardian, where her latest article is Revenge Porn is Being Used to Smear and Discredit a Sitting Congresswoman, joins us to discuss the moral and political challenges for feminists in the Me Too era. Then finally, we'll examine the impeachment case likely to be made in the House, then tried in the Senate, with Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. The author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, he joins us to explain how Pelosi's guidelines are more favorable to Trump than those afforded Clinton. But that has not stopped the Republicans from whining, because they can only criticize the process, not dispute the facts. Before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners who are helping us sustain and build Background Briefing online. We are grateful for the donations from across the nation and around the world coming in at backgroundbriefing.org/donate that keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent as we weaponize facts against authoritarian fictions to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, the CEO of TRG Media and producers of the podcasts, including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which Rothkopf hosts. Previously, he was a senior official in the Clinton administration, was also the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, and he's the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Pleasure to be back.
Well, thank you. And of course, we're speaking on the day that the impeachment vote was taken and the guidelines were voted on and the impeachment proceeds. And I know you have feel that it's too narrow, the scope, which I want to talk to you about. But just to touch on the actual Constitution, Article 2, Section 1 says the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So I take it, based on the title of your new book, you feel that the first part of the conviction, treason, might well be invoked, although it doesn't look like it will be in what the House is planning on doing.
Well, not exactly. I treason has a very specific definition in the Constitution, and it requires not only that you aid and abet or provide comfort to an enemy, but per the law, it requires that enemy be someone we've actually declared war against. And in fact, we don't have an outstanding declaration of war against anybody right now in the world, except, I guess, North Korea, because we've never had an armistice there. And so, you know, the collaboration with the Russians, even to the extent to which it might have violated U.S. laws, would not be seen as exactly treasonous. That said, it is a betrayal of the country. And I think the president has serially betrayed the country, whether by going to the Russians to undermine our democratic processes, by defending the Russians, by serially giving them gifts in exchange for their support, whether it was the recent decision in Syria, which essentially cedes certain control of Syria to them, or decisions he's made regarding Crimea, Ukraine, withholding aid from the Ukrainians, of course, benefits the Russians, decisions regarding the INF treaty and undermining NATO and so forth. So he's put Russian interests ahead of ours, that's for sure. I think he's put Trump family and Trump organization interests ahead of ours. That's not exactly treason. It's just corruption. But it is a betrayal of the United States and the expectation that senior government officials do not put their personal interests ahead of the national interests. That question, of course, lies at the center of the current Ukraine scandal, where the president seems to be bartering aid that was approved by the United States Congress for support with a personal matter, his campaign to be reelected president of the United States. And I suspect there are many other examples of this that we will learn of over the course of the next months and years. So there's that. But of course, the Constitution specifies bribery, which enters into this case with regard to Ukraine, and high crimes and misdemeanors were left vague by the founders precisely because they felt that future Congresses ought to have the latitude to determine what they felt was a betrayal of trust by a senior official of the country.
So, given that Attorney General Barr is on this witch hunt, investigating the investigators, and Trump's already singled out his targets, Comey, Clapper, and Brennan, and that's clearly who Barr is going after, I find it highly coincidental that Trump is obsessed with going after Comey, Clapper, and Brennan, all of whom know all about what's in his counterintelligence file and in briefed him on the Steele dossier, etc. He's already gone after the counterintelligence people in the FBI with the real institutional knowledge. They've all been purged. McCabe, Strzok, Page, and Bruce Orr. Surely there's more than a coincidence there.
Oh, I think that's clear. I think Trump fears these people, and I think he is using a classic Russian tactic that dates back to the Stalin era of discrediting one's opponents, particularly those that are likely at some point to offer up evidence of wrongdoing. As it happens, every single person you mentioned is somebody who is patriotic and upholds the law, and so does not come forward and say, I discovered this, I saw that. They feel there's a process by which to do it. But there is no question but that senior government officials in the intelligence community and the law enforcement community during the run-up to the 2016 elections and immediately after are the people who are most concerned by Trump and his behavior. And the fact that you find people like Jim Clapper in that group or John Brennan in that group, let's set aside Comey for a second because he's a controversial figure, but also people like General Mike Hayden or Mike Morrell, a former acting CIA director, deputy CIA director. All of these people have said, I'm very concerned. And they're not these are not hysterical people who are prone to play in the world of politics. In fact, they've all avoided it for most of their careers. So the reason they're flagging it is because they feel a duty to say, this needs to be investigated. We need a process by which the truth can come out. There's more here than meets the eye.
And again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's the CEO of TIG Media, producers of podcasts including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which David Rothkopf hosts. Previously, he was a senior official in the Clinton administration and was also the editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. And he's the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump. So, David, why is it that everything we've been talking about, both in terms of Trump as a commander-in-chief and the steward of a national security being completely unsuitable for the job, because in the case of Ukraine, instead of helping this frail democracy with a young leader who got elected overwhelmingly to fight corruption, what did Trump do? He exported corruption to them and is helping Putin, who was trying to bring them down. And then in the case of selling out the Kurds in Syria, it all happened with a phone call with Erdogan, which remains secret. We don't know what they discussed, but we certainly know that the main beneficiary of Trump's actions in north of Syria are the Russians. And it's absolutely mystifying why he did it, and he's never been able to explain why he did it. So none of this and all of what we've been talking about with this jihad against the top intelligence officials and the counterintelligence officials, none of that is in the impeachment that was voted on today.
Well, again, what was voted on today was a process, and the process doesn't specify what the articles of impeachment will cover, and it doesn't even specify how the articles of impeachment will be reviewed or voted on. So you could, as we have had in the past, have multiple articles of impeachment at the end of a process, or you could have a process where you say, well, let's look at Ukraine, let's put together articles of impeachment pertaining to Ukraine, and then we reserve the right to look at other things and perhaps have other articles of impeachment. I feel that there is a perception among some Democrats that defining it very, very narrowly as the Ukraine case is smart, because they think it's easily communicated. It's clearly wrong. And we did see some reaction in public polling that suggested that the broad cross-section of American people, substantial majorities, felt that what the president did was wrong here. But I personally am uncomfortable with an approach that says, let's only consider Ukraine. Because first of all, Ukraine is directly associated with the Russia 2016 case. It all involves serving Putin's interests in the long run. And I also think that it's a terrible mistake to look at the Mueller report and to buy the GOP spin on it, that it was exoneration, when in fact, the second part of the Mueller report made a very clear case that there were multiple instances of obstruction of justice, which is clearly an impeachable offense. And the first part of the Mueller report said we did not have enough information in order to make the case about collusion, but identified over 100 instances of interaction with the Russians, and identified instances where witnesses from the Trump team were uncooperative or they lied, and which thus colored the investigation. And so we take that investigation and we apparently set it aside. I think that then is seen by the Republicans not only as vindication, but as precedent for what's acceptable. We have federal election law violations, in particular those associated with the case of the Southern District of New York that led Michael Cohen to be thrown in jail and which mentioned the president as a participant. But we also have federal election law violations in regard to Ukraine, and so there's a parallel there. We have instances where the president has abused his authority and ignored constitutional role of Congress, the oversight authority of Congress, has failed to comply with legitimate congressional requests for information, which are actually a matter of law that he should comply, and therefore that's also a violation of law. We have other instances as well where the President of the United States has essentially ridden roughshod over security procedures in the White House and granted all sorts of security clearances to people that shouldn't have them, including his daughter and her husband. And that this is extremely important, not just because they have access now to a lot of sensitive material, but the reason they couldn't get security clearances is that security professionals felt they were compromised by their overseas interests. And we have seen the president compromised, and we have seen him give classified information to foreign enemies, including specifically the day after Comey was fired, to the Russians, giving them, you know, classified intelligence we had gotten from the Israelis. And you know, I'm just skimming the surface, right? And you know, I don't think we have enough time here to list all of these things. But in my view, not prosecuting these things, not holding the president accountable, sets a terrible precedent. It allows the Republicans and the president to say this is considered acceptable behavior by the president. And it fails to make the case in the court of public opinion. And it is essential to make the case in the court of public opinion, because I think it will make it more likely that even if the Senate does not remove him from office, that ultimately the people do so in November. You know, beyond all of that, it's the right thing to do. It's what the Constitution calls upon the Congress to do. And as my final point here, in a rather long answer, you know, today in the wake of the congressional vote on impeachment, the minority leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, stood up and said, impeachment is anti-democratic. It undermines the people's right to choose. Well, of course, impeachment was part of the Constitution before we had a president. It is a democratic protection that the offices we hold will not be co-opted by corrupt people. If the president is removed from office, the vice president takes over the office, someone who is elected by the people. All the members of Congress who evaluate impeachment, whether they be members of the House or the Senate, were elected by the people. Impeachment is profoundly democratic. In fact, it is essential to democracy. And pursuing it in the case of such widespread corruption and threats to our national security is essential. And I don't think we should do that tactically. I don't think we should do it for political reasons. I think we should do it because it's right. And I think we need to do it in a sweeping way that says, if you violate the law, if you violate your oath of office, if you betray the country, you will be held accountable.
Well, it seems to me, just in closing here, David Rothkopf, the first part of the Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, conviction of treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanor, I would say the strongest case might well be treason, and it's the one that will resonate most with his base. You don't want half the country or a third of the country or 40% or whatever this cult of Trump's constitutes feeling betrayed and that there's been a deep state coup. But if he's not a traitor, then they got to make the case to the American people that this man who's our commander-in-chief is not acting in our interests, and he seems to be acting in his private interests in Ukraine against American interests, against democracy itself and the rule of law. And we don't know what he's doing in Syria, except it's something to do with a secret phone call and perhaps a deal he's done with Erdogan, but we know who the beneficiary is Putin. And then you can go through the entire list. It just seems so manifestly clear to me that there's something deeply wrong. This is the last man that you want in charge of our national security.
No question that that's true. I'm not going to get into debate about treason. The courts have determined that this very narrow definition, which requires declaration of war and active hostilities, is necessary to trigger treason. But I believe, as I said at the outset, that this president has betrayed the country, that he has done it since before he took office, that he has done it every single day that he's been in office, that he is a threat to our national security, that he is, in fact, the number one threat to our national security. He is a threat to our allies. He is a threat to the rule of law in the U.S. and internationally. He is a benefit to our enemies, and he should be removed from office. And he needs to be removed from office not as an affront to democracy, but as a way of protecting democracy. Because if somebody like Donald Trump is allowed to make the case that the president is above the law, that he can conduct international affairs to serve himself, that he can turn the government of the United States into a piggy bank and ignore the emoluments clause of the Constitution, the two emoluments clauses within the Constitution, if he can direct his attorney general to cease running a Department of Justice and turn it into personal defense attorneys for him that don't prosecute his allies, then essentially what he's done is he has undone the Constitution of the United States, and he's brought us right back to where we were prior to the onset of the American Revolution, where he has put in charge of the United States an unfit, unwell, emotionally unstable tyrant who considers himself above and beyond the reach of the law. That's why we fought that war. And I think we have to all do whatever we can to fight to ensure that the principles and the documents and the institutions that came out of it are preserved in the face of this very, very real threat.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's the CEO of TRG Media, producers of the podcasts, including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which David Rothkopf hosts. Previously, he was a senior official in the Clinton administration and also the editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. And he's the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. And his forthcoming book is Traitor, The Case Against Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the final speech today in the House by the freshman Congresswoman Katie Hill, who describes a double standard where the dirtiest kind of politics were used against her in a misogynistic culture that gleefully consumed naked pictures of her. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Moira Donegan, who's a writer living in New York, whose work has appeared in the London Review of Books, Book Forum, and the Paris Review. And she's a columnist at The Guardian, where her latest article is Revenge Porn is Being Used to Smear and Discredit a Sitting Congresswoman. Welcome to Background Briefing, Moira Donegan.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Katie Hill gave her last speech to the House today just after voting to impeach Trump, or at least to move forward with the impeachment inquiry. She said, I'm leaving now because of a double standard. I'm leaving because I no longer want to be used as a bargaining chip. And she talks about what right-wing media in collusion with her ex-husband have done to her. And I'm leaving because of a misogynistic culture that gleefully consumed my naked pictures, capitalized on my sexuality, and enabled my abusive ex to continue that abuse, this time with the entire country watching. So it is a loss. I actually had her at a forum that I do at UCLA Hammer Museum a couple of years back, I think it was, when she was first running, along with Katie Porter as well, who also won in Orange County. So they were both flipped Republican seats. Both of them are very impressive, and it just seems such a terrible loss to the Democrats. So what's your sense then of whether, will anybody pay a price except for Katie Hill?
You know, that's hard to say right now. I mean, Hill's resignation comes just after, you know, I think within a year of the House establishing new rules that prohibit members of Congress from having sexual relationships with their staff. And it's not entirely clear whether the relationship she has admitted to with a campaign staffer would fall under that new ethical violations rule. But it's a very, very recent development that this pretty clear breach of ethics is now also a breach of the House bylaws. And that was really done in the wake of the Me Too movement, where it was revealed that there were these pretty systemic exploitations of power being made by male politicians that were putting sort of ambitious young women in situations that they shouldn't have had to be in. And this is, you know, a slightly different case in which the relationship that's alleged seems to have been ongoing during her campaign. It does not seem to have been with somebody who worked in her congressional staff. She's alleged to have done that by her ex-husband, but that second affair seems to be a figment of his imagination, or at least it's unsupported by evidence. But it's very telling that the first person that this new congressional rule is being enforced against is a woman.
Well, but now we see that there are fingerprints of Steve Knight, the Republican who she defeated, Katie Hill defeated, and he was a longtime incumbent, and it looks like it's his campaign aides that have been fanning the flames and pushing this story along with the pictures. What we're learning in an article in the Los Angeles Times by Michael Finnegan and Matt Pierce is that apparently, the ex-husband, Kenneth Heslip, the guy that looks like he's guilty of revenge porn, he apparently was trying to shop the story. He first tried to shop it to Steve Daniels, the host of the Talk of Santa Clarita, which is the district that Katie Hill represented. And then eventually, of course, they didn't want to touch it. You know, decent, respectable journalists didn't want to touch it. But former campaign aides of Steve Knight, like Jennifer Van Leer of Simi Valley, ran with the story. And that seems to be, you know, what's happening here. It just is. I don't know whether it's going to affect Steve Knight getting his seat back, because guess who's going to run on the Republican side in the primary for that seat? None other than George Papadopoulos of the the famous foreign policy advisor to our great president.
Yeah, there's kind of a very prolific multiplicity of bad behavior emerging in this part of the Republican Party in California. But it appears that, as you were saying, Heslip is, you know, he's unemployed. He lives in a farm. On a farm in their district, taking care of apparently a goat and some animals, and he was very irate that Hill decided to end the relationship, and then irate further that she was, through lawyers, initially declining his request for alimony. So it does seem that he shopped these photos around. Hill claims that she did not know that the photos were being taken and did not consent to the photos being taken. And it's very telling and frankly very disturbing that he did find people willing to publish these and to put them out into, you know, a national media outlet without her consent, and that those people were campaign aides for a longtime member of Congress.
Well, it is extraordinary to see the the conservatives and the Republicans now suddenly being champions of the Me Too movement, and they all sort of slavishly support the head of their party, the GOP, otherwise known as the Grab Our Pussy Party, Donald Trump.
Yeah, this is something you see or I've seen a lot in Me Too cases, is that the way that people interpret them, and you see this on the left and the right, although it's quite striking, it's quite a striking kind of hypocrisy in this case, I think. The ethical standard of things like, you know, you should not be sleeping with people who work for you because that is unethical and it puts them in an unfair bind. That's a standard that people are very happy to hold their enemies to and a lot more reluctant to hold their friends to. It does seem like there is a degree of political opportunism being taken in the Me Too movement that has more to do with advancing political agendas than with upholding the principle that, you know, women should not be the targets of sexual harassment or sexual assault.
Well, you're working on a book, are you not, about the moral and political challenges for feminists in the Me Too era?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I think about this stuff all day.
Well, you better get it off your chest. When's the book coming out?
Oh, next year.
I see. Oh, well, you've got another few months of turmoil there, right?
Yeah, it never ends. And, you know, it is sadly sort of an evergreen topic.
Well, how would you then compare this to the ones that we've been familiar with, the Harvey Weinsteins, the Donald Trumps, etc.? It just seems there's no symmetry there at all.
Yeah, it does seem a tad asymmetrical. I mean, look, I will say what I think most feminists are going to tell you, which is that no one, male or female, should be sleeping with people who work for them. It's unethical. It challenges the concept of consent, because how meaningful can an employee's consent really be when saying yes is or reasonably could be interpreted as a condition of their job? You know, so I don't want to defend Hill's conduct there. That said, what you also have to consider is sort of the enormity of what has been done to her in response, and the very specifically gendered implications of what has been done to her in response, which I don't think anybody could consider as justified. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say that Hill is also a victim of misogyny in this instance. So, like, the thing about revenge porn in particular is that it is really predicated on the reality that there is no victim that a misogynist culture would consider as worthy and perfect, right? Because under the logic of misogyny, if you were really worthy of privacy and of belief and of being taken seriously and of not having your naked pictures published on the internet, then you wouldn't have naked pictures at all, right? You wouldn't be having sex at all. If you want to be taken seriously as a woman, you should live this sort of chaste and perfect life, devoid of any blackmailable, even consensual sexual activity. And that's just not a reasonable standard. And it's one that Katie Hill couldn't live up to, but I also think it's one that nobody could live up to.
So do you think then that the Republicans can get any mileage out of this? Back in 2014, there was a piece in Vanity Fair by Monica Lewinsky, and it mentioned that Republican Senator Rand Paul had invoked the affair with Clinton, Bill Clinton, to demonstrate that it was the Democrats, not the Republicans, who were guilty of a war on women, because, according to Rand Paul, Bill Clinton had committed workplace violence and acted as a predatory manner against Monica Lewinsky, who, from what I recall, was actually quite a willing participant. Was that your memory of it as well?
Well, I was about six. Are you? When,
well, you shouldn't have been following this story then.
I think something really interesting about the Monica Lewinsky case is that, and you know, to a degree, the Katie Hill, a lesser degree, the Katie Hill case as well, but the Monica Lewinsky case really underscores the insufficiency of consent as a tool for measuring the political position of sex, because by all factual accounts, by all accounts that we have of the Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky's affair, both were very enthusiastic participants, right? So the willingness of the less powerful person is really not in question. The thing that's a little bit ethically troubling about the Lewinsky case is, like, well, what if she wasn't willing? And how would she have said no, right? So, like, if no is not really a reasonable option, as I would argue it's not when you are a 22-year-old intern facing a sexual proposition from the leader of the free world who's much older and also happens to be your boss, I don't think, like, it can be, we can say that this is an entirely ethical and feminist sex act when no is not a reasonable option for one of the persons involved. So that's sort of what gets me hung up a little on the Bill Clinton case and on sort of these, like, workplace affairs in general, when you have relationships that are ongoing between somebody who is somebody's employee and somebody who's their boss. The possibility to say no comes with, you know, consequences that the less powerful person might find unbearable. And those potential consequences, I think, are quite ethically troubling.
But,
does that make sense?
But do you think, yeah, it does. But Moira, do you think that when Katie Hill made it very clear that she identifies as being bisexual, as does Senator Kyrsten Sinema, the senator, Democratic senator from Arizona, who got elected, and that didn't seem to bother her constituents. The extent to which people are more open now, you know, and frankly, it's usually the Republicans who stay in the closet. Remember the guy with the wide stance, Senator Larry Craig? Again, maybe you don't, because it was a few years back. He was caught in a bathroom situation, clearly soliciting sex from a man who happened to be a undercover cop. He, of course, continued to deny that he anything to do with being a homosexual. So how much is being in the closet as opposed to being out of the closet? Is it any protection now in this current era?
I think it's quite a different proposition for men and women, because what you're clearly seeing in the Hill case is that straight men's sexual interest in sex between women is being manipulated to sort of titillate the audience for these right-wing news outlets, at the same time that it's, you know, that the photos are also being used to sort of smear Hill. So there's this, like, media strategy around Katie Hill in particular, but I would say sort of like women who have sex with women more generally, where they are presented to straight men on the right with this kind of like mixture of arousal and contempt. With men like that congressman you refer to who get caught in a bathroom, it tends to be that kind of closeted male congressperson. When you see them on the right, that the public objection seems to be a sense of hypocrisy, because they're often homophobic or sexually moralistic in their rhetoric or in their policy stances. So people see it as an instance of those lawmakers not quite practicing what they preach. But I do think you see, like, distinct versions of homophobia targeted at men and women in the political scene and in public life more broadly.
Well, of course, Kevin Spacey, the actor, tried to use the fact that he was in the closet, and there was this cultural stigma that basically he was trying to use it as an excuse for preying on minors. So, and I take it didn't work for Kevin Spacey. But what do you think about, for example, Senator Al Franken sort of trying to make his way back? Is there a path back for people that have been sort of publicly shamed?
You know, this is an interesting question that gets posed to feminists a lot. It's like sort of like, it's like, well, what is he supposed to do now? And I think that when we allow these people back into public life and sort of arenas of public respect and arenas where they can make a lot of money, after it's been, like, sort of broadly acknowledged or credibly accused that they are violent towards women or abusive and predatory towards women in this way, we sort of imply to women that we don't take their pain very seriously, or we don't interpret what happened to them as real harm. So it's like sort of every time somebody like Al Franken comes back a little, it does sort of imply to me that, you know, there's people in our communities and in our culture who were sort of okay with hurting, and kinds of hurting that we, kinds of harm that we consider acceptable to be done. That said, you know, I don't believe it is impossible for human beings to grow and change. I do think we owe it to women to ask for some proof that they've done that.
Well, I'd direct our audience to the article that you have, Moira, at The Guardian, about Harvey Weinstein trying to make his return into the public spotlight. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Ian, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I mean, speak with Moira Donegan, who's a writer living in New York, whose work has appeared in the London Review of Books, Book Forum, and the Paris Review. And she's a columnist at The Guardian, where her latest article is Revenge Porn is Being Used to Smear and Discredit a Sitting Congresswoman. And she's currently writing a book about the moral and political challenges for feminists in the Me Too era. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into how the impeachment guidelines are more favorable to Trump than those afforded Clinton. But that has not stopped the Republicans from whining, because they can only criticize the process, not dispute the facts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thanks, Ian. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you. And it's a fairly momentous day with impeachment now being official, with the vote today in the House of 232 to 196 to proceed and to lay out the sort of pathway, the rules of the road, if you will, for impeachment. It's pretty extraordinary to see. Of course, it was all along, the vote was on partisan lines, but it's pretty amusing to see the Republicans whining about how unfair it all is to the president, when it seems from objective observers that, in fact, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats have been much fairer to President Trump in terms of due process than the Republicans were to Bill Clinton.
Yes, I mean, I think if anything, they've been overly patient. I've been critical of the speaker for waiting so long. I thought certainly after the Mueller report was released that day, as soon as people had a chance to read it, it was clear that there were the grounds for impeachment. And then once we had the phone call, even in the edited version that we all read, it was clear that he had committed yet another, certainly a high crime and a crime as well. And we've talked about how those are different things. The standard for impeachment is high crimes and misdemeanors, requires an abuse of power, and that was true of that phone call. And it also was likely a crime in the sense that it's a violation of our campaign finance laws. So I'd agree, and also say they've been almost too deferential in waiting so long.
So do you think, though, as a matter of law, this case is strong enough, even if there is this notion that impeachment is not necessarily about the law solely. It's as much about politics as the law. But it just if you were a lawyer trying this case in a regular court as opposed to in before the United States Senate, you think it's a strong case?
Yes. I mean, the issue in part one of the Mueller report, which Mueller very, very carefully concluded, might have been a crime there, but there wasn't sufficient evidence to say that there was about violating campaign finance laws, seeking the help of a foreign government, in that case, Russia. But in this case, the same issue, the same area of the criminal law is at issue. And now we have facts that are, without question, support the idea that there's a crime here. And so I think that this president, there is a question about whether a sitting president can be charged with a crime and is immune from office. I've argued that they shouldn't be, but I recognize that, that the Department of Justice has a different policy. But the test for what you're saying is once if he is removed, I think there should be a criminal case brought, both in the Ukraine matter and also in the matter of obstruction of justice, certainly in the 10 instances of obstruction of justice outlined in part two of the Mueller report.
So do you think, though, that having dispensed with the law, let's talk about the politics. Do you think the politics are strong enough? I mean, it's pretty clear. I keep making this point, mainly out of frustration, that Trump and the Republicans are so good at weaponizing lies, whereas the Democrats don't seem to be that great at weaponizing the truth. Now, they've got the truth on their side, but we know that the Matt Gaetzes and the Jim Jordans and all those sort of cult-like followers of Trump in the House, and I guess to a lesser extent in the Senate, are just going to be so disruptive throughout this entire process. And my sense is that, you know, they haven't so far haven't said a peep about what's been going on in these depositions in terms of the substance of what the evidence is. They haven't disputed it or even commented on it. They're trying to comment on the process. Now that the process is clear for all to see, and after all, they were calling for a vote. Now they've got the vote. It doesn't look like they're changing their tune one bit.
Right. And I think, you know, we just can't let them get away with taking, they're arguing the process because the facts support the fact that the president is guilty. And so it's the obligation of all of us, and I know you're doing this, to just lay out for the American people that here's what happened. And the polling, I think, is surging right now, and it has been in favor certainly of opening the inquiry and the proceedings, but also in favor as well of impeachment and removal, because when people hear what happened, it's common sense that of course there, you could say all you want that there was no quid pro quo. You could rob a bank and say, I'm not robbing a bank, while you're robbing the bank. And that's what the president keeps saying. But we, you know, if you read the transcript, you know what's going on. It's obvious that there is a deal. And I think the politics will follow from that the more the information spreads and the more people understand the wrongdoing both here but also in the Mueller report. And as public opinion surges, then that does put some pressure on members of the president's own party to do what happened during Watergate, and that's to put the country over your partisan politics. And, you know, right now, I think certainly there are not the votes to remove the president. You need 2/3 in the Senate. But I am hopeful that as people find out the truth, they'll put pressure on their representatives to act.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writings appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. So in the impeachment articles in the Constitution, it actually says treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. And the first two have not been invoked in this case. But could you make the case that what we've learned so far about this July 25th shakedown call between Trump and Zelensky and all the activities of Giuliani and these crooked bagmen that he's been using, do you think that Does that rise to bribery? Extortion? I mean, it looks like, what's the difference between extortion and bribery?
I'd have to look at the particular statutes, but even if it did, I wouldn't recommend going that route. To me, the president's strategy here, and the strategy of all presidents who want to be exonerated, is to try to argue the narrowest version of the law. The more this looks like a criminal inquiry, the more, and certainly if they're able to convince us this, the standard, which it should not be, should be reasonable doubt, the more the burden is pushed onto the people who are, like me, who are suggesting the president should be impeached and removed. So I think that I would want to stay far away from anything that's going to push us even closer to the idea that this is a criminal trial. What the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors does, and it comes from the British law of offices, Parliament's power to reserve, to remove officers and officials, is it gets us to see that, you know, the all the requirements, due process requirements, the burden of showing narrow statutes are being violated that exist in legal inquiry are really not what we're doing here. We're trying to ask, has this president done things that are so bad that he no longer enjoys the public trust? Has he abused the office in that way? And it's meant to have this sort of common sense inquiry rather than to be overly lawyerly, which is really, after all, about imprisoning people and protecting criminal defendants. This is about protecting the country from a lawless president, and that's the way that this has to be shaped. I was going to say, by the way, too, that on the question of the politics, one thing important here, too, you know, having said all this about the difference between criminal trials and high crimes and misdemeanors, there's some basic fairness that should be the same. And one of the ideas that I've been pushing is that we shouldn't allow the jurors to be part of the crime. If there's a juror, namely a senator, that was possibly involved here, I think they've got to be they have to recuse themselves. They can't participate in the trial. So the Washington Post had something about the senator from Colorado who had a meeting with Ukrainian diplomat and asking questions, at least, about whether or not this senator was involved in this Ukrainian mess. And that's one thing I haven't seen as much in the media that I want to see more of, more stories like that, asking to the extent that some of these Republicans who are going to be voting on guilt or innocence, were they involved? And if they were, certainly they should recuse. But overall, I've been stressing fairness matters, but this is not a criminal trial.
Right, but Corey Breschneider, if you did apply the rules of a criminal trial to the Senate being jurors, I mean, how many of the jurors are the Democrats running for president? They're running to get rid of this guy, so they wouldn't. They would not survive voir dire, would they?
I think that's a good point, and you don't want to overdo the analogy, because if there's any conflict of interest, then everybody would be recused. But I do think that if there is evidence of actual involvement in the crime itself, not in some abstract way, then it's just impossible to vote, because you're serving as a judge in your own case, and you're voting on whether or not really you should be exonerated. Now, I don't know that there is that evidence. I want to clarify that. The Washington Post had some suggestions that this is something worth looking into. But certainly if it does come out that there are senators who were involved in either the crimes to do with Russia or the crimes to do with Ukraine, then I don't see any argument actually for letting them vote.
Well, do you think, though, that the case could be made, and I don't know how much it's a part of the rules, if you will, or the way the Constitution has laid out. They've given the House broad mandate in terms of how they conduct impeachment. But my sense is that the real issue here, for me, since I tend to cover national security affairs, is that it's so clear to me that we have a president who's totally unsuited to be the commander-in-chief and a custodian of our national security. He is so dangerously derelict, and he may well be compromised, and he could even be working for the other side. But if you look at what he's done in Ukraine, he was clearly working either directly or indirectly for Putin's interests, against the interests of the United States. Mm-hmm. He wasn't defending this frail democracy. In fact, he was with a young leader who got a tremendous mandate to fight corruption, which is what he ran on. And what are we doing? What is Trump and company doing? They're imposing corruption on him. Right. And they're taking away arms, which they desperately need because they're under attack from Putin. So there's two ways about it. Putin is definitely winning here in this situation. And Trump and Giuliani and company are really helping Putin. They're not helping Ukraine, and they're not helping the cause of democracy against the encroachment of dictatorship. And then you can the other theater, which is the north of Syria, again, he did something that makes no sense to anybody in the military or the State Department in terms of national security, in terms of American interests, in terms of strategy. Nothing makes any sense. What clearly is going on there, that he was dealing with people on a person-to-person basis, both with Erdogan and Putin, who's, again, the real winner here. So the U.S. national security is subordinated to the president's own interests, whether it's getting dirt on a political opponent or whatever dirt Putin and Erdogan have on him or whatever deals that they're privately making. It's just so incredibly clear to me. Do you think you can make that case, that it even be clear to the people who support Trump? Because a lot of these Trumpsters, you know, they see themselves as patriots. Well, it's not patriotic to sell America out to Russia.
Yeah, I think there's some hope. I mean, when we see John Bolton testify, this is not somebody affiliated with the political left. He's about as right-wing as they come, and yet saying, look, there's a line. There's something that's not about party politics. And that's, yes, national security, the security of the country, and all these things are really connected. The reason why impeachment and removal, firing a president, is so connected to abuse of power is because this isn't any person who's out there. We're not talking about imprisoning an average citizen. We're talking about taking the reins of the most powerful office, possibly in the world, away from somebody who's using them in a way that puts us all at risk. So I see all of these, you know, we could talk about how to draft the articles of impeachment. I favor, you know, several that focus on different areas of the violation rather than one. But they do have a theme, which is this president is dangerous because of the way the office has been abused and the risk that that poses to the people of the United States.
So,
and really the world.
Yes.
As well.
Well, and, you know, if you were a Kurd, you would certainly be wondering what the hell happened here. And you know, in the big picture is that we don't really have a world now riven between ideologies of capitalism versus communism, whatever. It's really a struggle of democracy versus kleptocracies and despotic regimes. And if you could make the case, I mean, you can make the case that the leader of the most important democracy with the most, you know, sway on the planet, it is not standing up for democracy. If anything, he's coddling despots, and he seems to have much, much closer and better relations with despots than he does with allies, all of whom he is alienating. So there's something going on here that is just so troubling, and I just wish somebody could make a strong case. But just in closing, though, I wanted to ask you about this, the general idea that impeachment is a matter-of-fact thing. It is not exotic. It's in the Constitution. It's in there for a good reason. It comes from the British Parliament, from much is borrowed, in fact, in the House of Commons. They make the case. The case is tried in the House of Lords. That's the same here. You know, the case is made in the House and it's tried in the Senate. They have electors, which is what they also borrowed from the British model. So it's just a normal mechanism to pull over the head of the executive branch, whether it's a king or a president, who's abused power. So I just wonder whether Nancy Pelosi and company, in fretting over whether or not to impeach or not to impeach, all that Hamlet-like stuff that went on for so long, did they inadvertently make it seem like it was exotic and unusual, when in fact it is a pretty matter-of-fact process and it should be treated as something that is just solidly in the Constitution and is not controversial.
Yes, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I wrote this book, The Oath and the Office, because it is calling attention to the idea that the first second in office, the president takes an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And it was common for that to be referenced in inaugural addresses, because the idea was if you fail in that duty, the burden is on the president to show that he or she deserves the office, that they're doing the job. If you fail to do it, or worse, you oppose the Constitution, you oppose the ideals of defending the nation and the Constitution, then you get subject to removal. That's the idea. That's why they put it in this central way. It's a rejection of monarchy, a rejection of despotism, and it was the, without having an execution of a king, it was the normalized process of handling abuses of power. George Washington says in the second inaugural address, it's only 135 words, I quote it up front in the book, if I fail to live up to the oath, I'm paraphrasing, of course, do two things. One is criticize me, and if I really mess up, subject me to constitutional punishment. That's the president of the United States talking about how the dignity of the office requires removal of a president who doesn't take care that the laws be faithfully executed, who fails to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And yes, her hesitancy, I think, was sent the wrong message. This is clearly a power of Congress to act, and they should act really have acted much faster than they did to remove a president who doesn't get it, who abuses power. And we're without question there now.
Well, Corey Breschnatter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Breschnatter, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writings appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and engineer D'Angelo Jones. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can bookmark it, sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy this program, make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And be sure to share the program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And if you are in a position to support us so that we can sustain and build this program, visit us at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Your support will help spread the word and keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent. And we'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.